fight to keep this station alive. Whose station?
Our station.
This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI New York.
You got that right. Locally controlled WBAI New York. That's right. Put some Vaseline on your face, on your knees, because this fight is still ongoing. Did you hear the program last night talking about it? Trying to take away your station, our station. Not going to happen. We're not going to let it happen. Perhaps we'll talk about this later on in the program if you like. Or some of your stories as well. It is 11 o'clock here in New York City at 99.5 FM WBAI and WBAI.org on the web. I'm Michael G. Haskins. Good morning. Coming up next, Living for the City. Hello and welcome to Living for the City over WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. My name is Michael G. Haskins, the host of the program, and Living for the City is a program focusing on the telling of stories, our stories, our perspectives of local communities throughout our area and beyond. If you've lived in New York City for any length of time, you know how difficult it is to get the media, in some circumstances, to report about a subject in depth, tell the truth, or even cover an issue. We examine those very issues, especially dealing with the power of the real estate lobby, housing, land, air, and water use, truthfully and as accurately as possible. The we being myself, Michael G. Haskins, and Jillian Jonas, the senior producer here for Living for the City. And we've been working together for several years now. Delighted with her participation in this program and in the work that I've been doing over the last few years. So thank you all for tuning into the program Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Well, it's a story we have heard often, too often. In fact, residents say the city didn't conduct a proper environmental assessment to analyze the true effects of a development project on a community. The city and Department of City Planning are ignoring the zoning on the books. And in a classic way of the city doing business, it has pitted one deserving group against another. In this case, senior citizens versus community garden activists. With me are two people who can speak to what's going on at the Elizabeth Street Garden and why it matters so very much. With me is Joseph Reaver, the executive director of the Elizabeth Street Garden, and Felicia Young, founder and executive director of Earth Celebrations. Welcome to you both. Joseph, Felicia.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. And thank you to Jillian as well.
Hi. Felicia, you're there with us as well? You sound a little faint.
I am.
Okay. All right. Okay. Fantastic. Hi, all right, great. Joseph, let's start with you. Give us some background on the garden and how you came to file a lawsuit against the city.
Yeah. So the Elizabeth Street Garden is a community garden in Little Italy. Since 2013, The community has really been working to save the garden from being developed by the city. It is city-owned land. We're a nonprofit that keeps it open to the public. We're advocating to save it. And you know, throughout the years from 2013 up until just last year, we've been really, really working within the political process, the community process, to work with local elected officials in saving the garden and using an alternative site for a proposed development that would destroy the garden. So, you know, we went through that ULURF process, that land use review process,
mm-hmm.
That I'm sure, you know, many, many, many activists around the city are familiar with.
Very much so.
And it was very clear from the start, because our city council person wanted to develop over the garden to destroy it, it was very clear that the whole process was result-oriented. And it's still clear now. So when we went through that land use process,
Joseph, hold on for a second. Could you explain what does that mean, result-oriented?
That this process was slanted to push this development through the review process.
Right. I thought that's what you meant. I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead, Joseph.
And you know, we knew that our councilperson, Margaret Chin, wanted a development there, and that this land use review process would cater to that.
Mm.
And it did. And so, anticipating that, we retained our attorney, Norman Siegel, and we prepared a lawsuit over the course of a few years. And just at the end of that process, we filed because we anticipated that process would basically fail its initial purpose.
Mm-hmm. Joseph, if you wouldn't mind, Joseph Reaver, pinpoint where is this location? I used to live in that neighborhood for several years, and this is a wonderful community to live in. Tell me where the garden is, because the last time I was there, maybe 3 years ago, actually, I remember seeing a huge development taking place in there. So I just need to orient and find out where this is. Where is this community garden located?
Of course. It's on Elizabeth Street between Prince and Spring Streets.
Mm-hmm.
It's right in the heart of Little Italy.
Mm-hmm.
I say Little Italy, not Nolita.
Mm-hmm.
it's really the only real public green space in the neighborhood. There's parks around it,
mm-hmm.
but these parks are predominantly paved. They serve other purposes, which are, you know, wonderful in their own right, but different. And this Elizabeth Street Garden is really the only true green space with trees, with gardening beds, with a lawn and areas like that in Little Italy. And really, you know, it's one of the few ones in all of Community Board 2, the District of Community Board 2.
Mm-hmm. Switching over to you, Felicia mm-hmm. Young, the founder and executive director of Earth Celebrations. Why is this garden specifically, and community gardens in general, so important and so vital for and to New York City?
Well, this is the interesting thing. I mean, I've been involved in the garden preservation effort now for 30 years. And back in the early 90s, when we were trying to preserve over 60 community gardens on the Lower East Side, I mean, we were really thinking about the value that the community had created in these what were formerly neglected spaces in terms of open space and social cohesion and the positive community life and, you know, the need for more parks and green space.
Mm.
But I think what we didn't see then that played out after Hurricane Sandy was the importance of the gardens as really urban climate solutions.
Mm.
So had we not preserved the gardens through the effort that took over 15 years, we wouldn't have all these urban climate solutions. Now, as we're facing a closing window of 10 years on trying to reach goals of the Paris Climate Agreement to keep global temperatures below 1.5 degrees Celsius. Even the mayor himself has said, signed some executive order 26, saying that New York City will uphold the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement. Well, in order to reach those goals, the gardens are therefore providing all of the solutions that play into the city's own policy. So it makes absolutely no sense now, knowing we're in a climate crisis, to destroy the gardens that not only are providing all of these community cohesion and environmentally needed park space, but in the context of the city and global climate challenges, these are the solutions. So if you go and look at it specifically, I mean, the gardens are mitigating flooding. So when Hurricane Sandy happened, the gardens, being permeable surfaces, were able to absorb the flood water. There, and storms are only going to be increasing with climate change. And then they're also mitigating stormwater pollution runoff from flowing into the river. So they're also improving water quality. Community gardens, the trees, the plants, the soil sequester carbon. These are vital climate solutions that are being provided by the gardens. The trees are providing filtering pollutants. They're providing fresh air. You know, there's also what we call the heat island effect. And with rising temperatures, the city, with all the concrete, is only increasing temperatures and the consequences of that within the city. And the gardens are also mitigating those impacts by cooling not only the immediate garden, but the entire surrounding neighborhood. So if you go through all of the climate solutions, it makes absolutely no sense, because if you look at what one senior housing facility is going to provide in the bigger picture versus taking away this space that you will never get again, and all of the climate solutions that were really about the sustainable future of the city. So this is exactly what the community should be investing in. They're always interested in putting billions of dollars to some green infrastructure project that doesn't already exist, whereas here the community has cultivated and handing it over to the city that should be absolutely included as part of the plan. So I always say this is about, you know, community grassroots improvisation that provides a plan for a future sustainable city.
It's actually a bit of a no-brainer if you think about it. They are coming up with all of these consultations and think tanks around this, but as you've said, Felicia Young, the community has done the work and provided it to the city, just almost on a platter.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that, I think, is what, you know, I think is another way of seeing it. I mean, the community needs open space, needs the park. It's one of the most beautiful spaces and gardens within all of New York City. And tourists from around the world know about this space. I mean, it functions on so many different
levels,
and
right,
all of the cultural programming and educational programming, and at a time when people and children in the city need to understand climate and these issues in a more visceral way, this is the kind of direct connection and the kind of environmental education that this is where it takes place, not just in a classroom, locally on our streets, in these gardens, where people can have a connection to nature in the city and cultivate the solution.
A very good point.
It infuriates me.
I understand. Felicia. Felicia Young is one of my guests this morning today on Living for the City here over WBAI, the founder and executive director of Earth Celebrations, engaging communities to generate ecological and social change through the arts. I think it's very interesting. And just staying with this for another moment, Felicia, the Paris Climate Accord that you referenced earlier, I think it's very interesting how this connection between a global effort, that is the Paris Accords, is taking place, or right here in New York City, there are connections between what happened on the other side of the world and what's going on right here. Everything is local.
Exactly. Mm. So I think that's been a big shift in the way people think about things, that, you know, global challenges are played out with local solutions.
Yes.
And also what we do here in New York City is often looked at from other cities around the world. Mm. So we're not the only city developing solutions, but, you know, we are a city where I feel the administration has often overlooked what happens on the grassroots level, what happens on the neighborhood level. And there should be a way that we can really quantify this contribution and have these efforts included in a city plan.
Once again, you're listening to WBAI's Living for the City, and I'm your host, Michael G. Haskins. I'll be here until just before 12 o'clock. We have a newscast coming up at about 11:55, so we hope that you'll stay tuned, stick around for the rest of this program and the newscast and on into the rest of our afternoon. Joseph Reaver, I'd like to swing back to you. Community Board 2 has stated that the city's open space planning goal of at least 2.5 acres per 1,000 residents is unobtainable. Do you believe that's the case? Is it obtainable? Can this be this goal be realized?
It definitely can't be with planning that involves destroying spaces like the garden. I do believe in a more optimistic realm, if you will, that we absolutely can. You know, it starts with community-based solutions. Like saving Elizabeth Street Garden, like seeking out space that is not as well utilized right now. And, you know, I think that open space, we're realizing right now, especially in the time of COVID, the vitality of open space. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether it's in the streets for restaurants, whether it's in parks or community gardens, you know, Our entire reality is shifting with an emphasis towards open space.
It sure is.
And so this is the time to have bold and creative ideas to achieving more open space and also achieving more affordable housing, truly low income housing. You know, this is an issue that pits these two against each other, but that's a false choice. And so I do think it is obtainable. Again, it starts with saving Elizabeth Street Garden, especially in Community Board 2.
Mm-hmm. Now,
and if we're going to...
Finish your thought.
I was going to say, if we're going to have city council members, our mayor, and other elected officials, you know, talking about the Paris Agreement or talking about, you know, the need for sustainability, then they really need to back that up and put their money where their mouth is and really, really invest in saving these spaces, invest in the communities that are fostering and sustaining these spaces, and really, you know, really not say one thing and do another.
And do another. Let's just pause here for a moment and let's let people know how they can become involved. At the very least, get more information about Elizabeth Street Garden. Joseph Reaver, how can folks do that?
They can, first and foremost, stop by the garden where our temporary hours, since we reopened after the shutdown, are Wednesday through Sunday. And on our website, elizabethstreetgarden.com, we have all the visiting hours there where we're open through the winter. You can visit the website to volunteer. I say stop by first and foremost because, you know, you got to really see the space because it truly is a magical space. And it's inspiring and people form their own connections with it as they do with all of the unique gardens around the city.
Okay.
But, you know, ElizabethStreetGarden.com, they can donate to the legal fund. They can read about the history there. They can also volunteer. We're on social media at Elizabeth Street Garden. And if you just search Elizabeth Street Garden on Twitter, will pop up.
Okay, great. Well. All right. I'm going to have to hop on the 6 train and get on back down to my old neighborhood. That's Joseph Reaver. Felicia Young, what about you and Earth Celebrations? How can people get in contact?
Yes. Well, we're actually currently working on the Ecological City Project, which brings together climate solutions throughout the community gardens, neighborhood, and waterfront on the Lower East Side. And we've always included Elizabeth Street Garden, you know, within that in terms of telling its story.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a community both art and action project that takes place now through May, culminating in a pageant, which will take place in a physically distant requirement, but it will take place.
Mm-hmm.
And people can get involved. They can reach us on our website, earthcelebrations.com. We're also Earth Celebrations on Facebook, and they can participate in our arts and climate solutions workshops that will take place through the spring, and volunteer to be part of the pageant in whichever form it can take place.
Oh, my goodness. All right, the pageant. I love the way that sounds. And I love what you said also, Felicia Young, Elizabeth Street Garden telling its story. It so fits in to what this program is about, telling our stories. And the garden has its own story. The neighbors that live, the people that live in and around Elizabeth Street Garden have their own story. So it's a wonderful thing, a wonderful connection that you made. This is Living for the City. Felicia Young, let us ask you now, I would like to ask you, why have community gardens been so important during the pandemic? Now, I know how they're important to me. We're not gathering in our homes, unfortunately, in our apartments the way we used to. We would have people come over and socialize, visit. We're not doing that. It became, just until it really started getting cold for me, where we could sit down in the community garden right adjacent to my house to where we could sit down and talk in the community garden. Why is it so important during this particular time that we're living in?
Well, we are all suffering from extreme, I think, social isolation. And both our parks, our streets, our public commons, and the garden provide a space where, you know, we can have some relief and connection to both the natural world and our neighbors. And, you know, unfortunately, I mean, when we were under lockdown in the spring, the gardens were actually, most of them locked. You know, now I think some of the gardens, you know, are open, but with limited numbers of people that can be in it, you know, at a particular time.
Right.
But because they function within the neighborhoods and memberships, you know, the members have usually always had access to going in. So, that's the challenge given this crisis we're in, that, you know, even wherever we may gather, we always have to keep physical distancing in mind, even outside.
Mm-hmm.
But it is so vital, and I think that's the thing. We're all getting tired of Zoom as our means of social connection and, you know, we need to have our public commons, our spaces, to find our neighbors and find something that is vital to, you know, our lives.
Mm-hmm. And Joseph Reaver, this project, how has it been marketed? And has the truth been twisted or stretched a bit with relation to the senior housing? And I'm going to come to that in a moment, but what you've seen, what you've been involved in, has this been twisted or stretched at all?
Absolutely. You know, I'd say that first and foremost, the city really created that sense of divide, where they want us to believe that this is an issue of housing versus green space or seniors versus community garden. They want to create that divide, and what that does is that takes people who are passionate about both issues, and it causes them to clash with one another. We get into the weeds of the many intricacies of the matter, and we lose sight of that bigger picture. But that's not the case. You know, this really, it's a false choice to pit these two vitalities against each other. And then to go further within the development itself, you know, it is low income senior affordable housing. It's not permanently affordable. That's an important aspect to note. But it also includes luxury retail and office space for one of the developer partners, Habitat NYC, and quite a significant amount of office space for them. And they've really, you know, they've continuously referred to that office space as a community facility, because they are a nonprofit and they offer certain services throughout the city. But it's important to note that it is their office space. And they already have existing office space within Manhattan to fulfill the different duties that they're fulfilling. One of the main things is that they've tried to say that there's this a win-win compromise that they've achieved by building a small portion of open space with the development. That is, Elizabeth Street Garden would still be entirely destroyed. They would build 6,700 square feet of open space that's managed by the developer partners. But they're also required to provide some open space. So it's not that they're, you know, stretching and providing this win-win compromise. They're required to do some variation of this. But even so, with everything that's within this development, the community board back in 2015 designated another much more viable alternative site for the housing, and that's at 388 Hudson. And 388 Hudson is just a gravel lot. It can offer five times the amount of housing, up to five times, because they could build much higher. And it's something that could have already been achieved if the city really took it seriously and really considered building on that site instead of destroying a beloved community garden and building there. So in twisting the marketing of this development and in creating that false divide, they've really tried to focus on this what I say is an orchestrated issue, senior housing versus community gardens, instead of, you know, coming up with more viable solutions, community-based solutions, solutions that don't create that sense of divide. Because it's a failure of city government to create that sense of divide.
Right. Now I understand that the site really wasn't dedicated for senior housing as it's currently configured. But the plan doesn't necessarily help seniors living in the area. Is that true? And could you explain that a bit?
Well, it does and it doesn't. They've said, as part of a response to 388 Hudson, which is in the same community board district, and I'll get to why that's important in a second. But they've said, we need seniors aging in place. And this is Little Italy, and 388 Hudson is a little bit more west. But the reality is that affordable housing, the lottery, is distributed by community board district. So the same 50%, it's 50% of the units, there's 123 units in the proposed development. 50% of those units would go to a lottery within Community Board 2. So it doesn't really matter between 388 Hudson and where Elizabeth Street Garden is. The same 50% will go to that district. And then 50% goes citywide to those in need. So it's something that we, you know, it's an important thing to note, because it's not exactly about that. About aging in place in terms of 388 Hudson versus Elizabeth Street Garden, if that's the way they put it.
As we prepare to conclude our conversation today, Felicia Young, the founder and executive director of Earth Celebrations, there's been suggested alternative sites to the city. I guess we'll start with Joseph and then come back to you, Felicia. How did you choose those sites, and how did the city respond? Actually, I have something else for you, Felicia. But coming back to Joseph Reaver, how did you choose those alternate sites?
Well, the community board really focused on 388 Hudson as an alternative site, the one I just spoke about. And what's sad is that if they really considered it, then we could have had the housing in need without the idea of destroying Elizabeth Street Garden. There's also other locations that have been noted by many community board representatives, many people within the community, sites like 2 Howard Street, which is right now just a federal parking lot that could provide a significant amount of apartments if it were rezoned. And I guess you could build more there and you can repurpose it. There's also, the idea, and I touched on this a little bit in the past, using the vacancies and this opportunity, the vacancies that exist because of COVID right now, and getting creative with that and really examining how the city could step in and create tens of thousands of affordable housing units with the existing vacancies instead of destroying community gardens to build it. They say they focus on the need for affordable housing, but they're not really focusing on the creative means to achieve it. And that really takes bold choices. Looking at these vacant apartments, the city could lease them. There's a wonderful opinion piece in AM New York about it goes into the logistics of how they can actually save money in leasing these spaces. But really, I just want to touch on one thing before we conclude it. It's that they've ignored these alternative sites because, to tie it back, it's a result-oriented process that the city's a result-oriented approach. They've countless times they've said the garden serves no significant impact, no negative impact in destroying the garden. That's what they've referred to in all of the Euler papers at the hearings, and even in the legal papers, in the environmental assessment that was a complete failure in depicting what the garden does. They say continuously no significant impact. There would be no negative impact in destroying Elizabeth Street Garden. The city's lawyer said Elizabeth Street Garden is not inherently integral to the character of the neighborhood. And everything that Felicia was speaking about, all of the important aspects of community gardens in general, but also with Elizabeth Street Garden, with all of the open space, existing as an outdoor museum because there's sculptures, having the many free public programs we offer like yoga, tai chi, movie screenings, live music, a place for outdoor recreation and gathering, having educational programs with local public schools, fostering that sense of community in an otherwise hyper-gentrified area, all of that, when you say there's no negative impact in destroying that, you're basically saying there's all of what I just mentioned has little to no significance for our city. And that shows you the mindset that the city approaches these controversial developments with. I truly believe that any truthful, strictly objective, hard look, which it would really be an environmental impact statement, which they avoided doing, or they tried to avoid doing, that would show that our community would be absolutely devastated if Elizabeth Street Garden isn't saved.
It is truly a beautiful space. I'm remembering the times that I spent there and visited that area. It is truly quite beautiful. Joseph Reaver, thank you very much. As we wrap up, Felicia Young, what's in the future? What future plans are there that you have, your organization, Earth Celebrations, and as a matter of fact, a wonderful name for an organization, Earth Celebrations. What are your future plans?
Well, I think it touches upon exactly what we're speaking about here, the need and importance for the city to recognize the grassroots urban climate solutions. And these exist not only within the Lower East Side, but throughout neighborhoods. That story gets played out throughout neighborhoods throughout the city of
New
York,
right.
In
That's
multiple
right.
boroughs, mostly low-income and culturally diverse communities, where out-of-city neglect They have, with their own sweat, energy, and ingenuity, created these spaces, developed these solutions for the future. So this is where, you know, I'm trying to direct Earth celebrations through the Ecological City Project, hopefully being able to expand those ideas to engage community and reaffirm these urban ecosystems that exist in neighborhoods throughout New York, and to get the city to recognize what the community has created for the future of the city. Mm-hmm. I mean, we shouldn't be having to battle. We should be having these spaces honored. They should be given even more funding and more support by the city. You know, this is what needs to happen. And, you know, hopefully we will be able to get people with, you know, elected officials and people within power who have a vision for a future sustainable city, and not just say it, but actually take a look at what the community is creating, because I think that's where the future is.
All right. Well, thank you very, very much. Let's get some contact information again. I asked you earlier in our conversation, but let's revisit that. Joseph Reaver, the executive director of Elizabeth Street Garden.
You can go to elizabethstreetgarden.com.
Mm-hmm.
Also, anyone who's interested can email me personally at Joseph, J-O-S-E-P-H, at elizabethstreetgarden, all spelled out, .com. And before all else, come by, stop by and see the garden.
Stop by and see the garden.
See all of the magic it offers.
There you go. Joseph Reaver, thank you so much. Felicia Young? How do we get in contact with Earth Celebrations?
Reach out and join us for our Ecological City Cultural and Climate Solutions Action Project, talking about all of these issues in a very creative way. And they can reach us through our website, earthcelebrations.com, that's plural, and also we're on Facebook and other social media. You can find us.
Excellent. Thank you both so much for coming on Living for the City today.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Felicia Young, the founder and director of Earth Celebrations. That's an S on the end of that. Earth Celebrations, engaging communities to generate ecological and social change through the arts. And Joseph Reaver, executive director of Elizabeth Street Garden. It is a wonderful, wonderful place. Took me a moment to reimagine what that place, but it is quite beautiful. So that's Elizabeth Street Gardens. We'll be back with more on Living for the City. And once again, you are tuned to WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. I'm Michael G. Haskins, your host, your radio host and guide, actually, in the mornings for WBAI. I'm going to take a step back. Here we go, our Sankofa Moments in Time. Taking a look back in history to see where we've come from, to help us understand how we come to exist in this moment as we approach 2021 and how to chart a course for the future. This day in peace and social justice history, we'll try to squeeze in some time for your phone calls at 212-209-2877. Last week, I told you the story, the somewhat harrowing story of my wife and I's visit to Utah in the, not the depths of the winter, but the beginning of the winter. It was quite cold, the 27th of December. But what about your stories? I want to hear your stories. Give me a call at 212-209-2877. After a couple of more things, we'll leave some room for you to call in to Living for the City. On this day, in peace and social justice history, December 9th, 1917, British troops known as the Egyptian Expeditionary Force and under the command of General Edmund Allenby entered Jerusalem, ending 700 years of Muslim rule of the city, 400 under the Ottoman Turks. The Turkish army withdrew. The city surrendered without a battle. Thus began 30 years of British control over Palestine. In 1949, on this date, U.S. Representative John Parnell Thomas, former chairman of the House Un-American Activities Committee, or HUAC, was sentenced to 6 to 18 months in federal prison for, quote, padding, unquote, congressional payrolls and using the money himself, also known as embezzlement. He had pled no contest to the charges and was pardoned by President Harry Truman shortly before the end of his presidency. In 1961, on this date, members of the National Committee of 100, a movement of nonviolent resistance to nuclear war and to the manufacture and use of all weapons of mass extermination, joined with the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, CND, and held demonstrations at various U.S. air and nuclear bases in Britain. Members of the Committee of 100, including Bertrand Russell, considered civil disobedience a legitimate means in their struggle. The CND avoided all illegal activities. And finally, on this day in peace and social justice history, December 9th, 1990, Solidarity trade union founder and leader Lech Walesa won Poland's presidential runoff election in a 3-to-1 landslide. He thus became the first directly elected Polish leader. Poland only became an independent country at the end of World War I. And that's this day in peace and social justice history here over Living for the City on WBAI at 99.5 FM. And now, labor history in 2 minutes with Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1958. That was the day 12 ultra-conservatives, including Robert Welch, Fred Koch, and Harry Lynn Bradley, gathered in Indianapolis to found the John Birch Society. These men saw cabals and communist conspiracies everywhere. They mobilized their vast financial resources to fuel Cold War paranoia. They opposed New Deal policies, the Civil Rights Movement, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs, and the Equal Rights Amendment. They funded Barry Goldwater's presidential bid in 1964, denounced Richard Nixon as a fake, and warned of his establishment of diplomatic ties with China. The Birchers also opposed water fluoridation, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. They pressed for the U.S. to withdraw from the United Nations and viewed the U.S. war in Vietnam as a plot to bring communism to the United States. Welch, a candy manufacturer, even asserted that President Dwight David Eisenhower was simply a tool for the communists and an advocate of a one-world new order. More recently, many Birchers have also helped to found and fund the National Right to Work Committee, whose legal defense arm has pushed hard for anti-union legislation. Prominent members like the Koch brothers have funneled millions into the National Right to Work Committee in order to bust unions, kill the Employee Free Choice Act, and weaken the regulatory authority of the National Labor Relations Board. Their current headquarters are in Appleton, Wisconsin, hometown of Red Scare warrior Senator Joseph McCarthy.
Well, I run down most hurriedly and joined the John Birch Society. Got me a secret membership card, started walking off down the road. Oh boy, I'm a real John Bircher now. Look out, you're
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Labor History in 2 minutes with Rick Smith. I like the inclusion that Rick has put into the Labor History in 2 minutes, having some folk music played. I'm going to wrap this up, bringing you this, and then let's take a phone call or two, shall we?
Better for the future.
Hold on, Gloria, one more time, please.
As we know, Sankofa is to understand our past, to better understand our present, so that we can plan better for the future.
All right. Thank you very much, Gloria J. Brown Marshall. We may hear from her again in this program. She has a program called Law of the Land Tuesdays at 9 a.m. But let's hear from you now. Good morning. You're on WBAI.
Hi. Good morning, Michael. This is Bobby from Flushing. I just want to say
Bobby from Flushing. Go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you for having Professor Hum on to talk about the Flushing rezoning.
Ah, yes.
Nobody really is talking about this here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's causing a lot of displacement already. And if should this pass, it's going to cause even more displacement. As I told you,
yes.
I work at the food pantry here, and we're feeding 10,000 people every week here.
Wow.
We can't. I have to be going to court with elderly women who are being taken to court before the pandemic. 72-year-old lady being harassed by these landlords.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I told you about my building. It's 92 units, and we have 35 that's empty. These people call ICE on the tenants.
Mm-hmm.
They shut the heat off. They shut the water off. There's a building that's right next to my building, 132-30. The entire building is empty, Michael. They kicked out every person out of the building. They told the people it's no longer rent stabilized. And then right now they flipped the building and it's now selling a condo for $1 million.
Bobby,
you can't walk down one of the streets here in Flushing without seeing high-rise going up.
I'm so glad. Yeah, I don't mean to cut you off, Bobby, but thank you very much for bringing our attention. I remember Jillian, when I told her about this and about the phone call, actually she was listening, she said going to Flushing and doing that story was next on the list of things that she wanted to do. So I'm very glad that you that you called up then. Bobby, would you mind calling me back after the program is over? I'd like to follow up on this. There are some other things, some bases that we didn't cover as I'm hearing you talk about now. So give me a call back after the program is over with and we'll talk further, okay?
Okay, I just want to just say to everybody out there, please call your city council member because it's in front of the city council right now, and they're about to vote in the land use committee today or tomorrow.
Okay, thanks very much. Appreciate. Thank you, Bobby.
I'll call you back.
Okay, great. Thanks very much for that. And you know, this is why this station is so important. This is community involvement. Call your city council person, and please call our pledge line. Don't forget that, because that makes this program and that phone call from Bobby possible. It does. You can't get that anywhere else. I'm sorry. I wish it were the case. I wish there were many BAIs, but it's not. Good morning. You're on WBAI.
Hi, Michael G. It's Arnold. How you doing?
Arnold, a longtime listener and supporter of this radio station. Yes. Good morning, Bob.
I want to talk about an experience. I was with my cousins up in, we hiked from British Columbia into Alberta. And I'll never forget, seeing from a distance a grizzly bear with three cubs.
Oh, my.
And we had to be very quiet.
What kind of distance? Well, I mean, listen, the grizzly bear, the mama bear, she smelled you already by the time you walked onto her. How far away were you?
We ran like we didn't run before.
Yeah,
we ran about a mile up to this small little town up in Alberta, and we were lucky to get into someone's house because Mama Bear knew, you know, Mama Bear was, you know, coming out to get us.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, particularly around those cubs, they can get very, very aggressive.
That's an experience right there up in the Canadian Rockies. Yes. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, the vastness of the area.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Well, thank you,
Mike. Have a happy holiday.
All right. I appreciate that. Thank you so much. And same to you. Do we have time to share this? I think we do. I think we do. And I want to share it. Just a little piece of something that I did not too long ago. It was in the mornings. So give a listen.
When the sun go down,
when the sun go down,
I'll be so glad. When the sun go down,
I know, let's leave it,
but
I
don't want to lie down.
I know, let's leave it, but
when her mistress died, her son-in-law, Dr. Flint, was appointed executor. When grandmother applied to him for payment, he said the estate was insolvent and the law prohibited payment. It did not, however, prohibit him from retaining the silver candelabra which had been purchased with that money. I presume they will be handed down in the family from generation to generation. My grandmother's mistress had always promised that at her death she should be free, and it was said that in her will she made good the promise. But when the estate was settled, Dr. Flint told the faithful old servant that under existing circumstances, it was necessary she should be sold.
Chapter 13, The Church and Slavery. After the alarm caused by Nat Turner's insurrection had subsided, the slave owners came to the conclusion that it would be well to give the slaves enough of religious instruction to keep them from murdering their masters. The Episcopal clergymen offered to hold a separate service on Sundays for their benefit.
Did the child feign what she did not feel, or was her mother jealous of the might of love she bestowed on me? I concluded it must be the latter, I said to myself. Surely, little children are true. One afternoon I was sewing, feeling unusually depression of spirits. My mistress had been accusing me of offense, of which I assure her I was perfectly innocent. But I saw by the contemptuous curl of her lip that she believed I was telling a lie.
She offered to manumit her slaves, telling them that her marriage might make unexpected changes in their destiny, and she wished to ensure their happiness. They refused to take their freedom, saying that she had always been their best friend, and they could not be so happy anywhere as with her. I was not surprised. I had often seen them in their comfortable home, and thought that the whole town did not contain a happier family. They had never felt slavery, and when it was too late, they were convinced of its reality. When the new master claimed his family as his property, the father became furious and went to his mistress for protection. I can do nothing for you now, Harry, she said. I no longer have the power I had a week ago. I have succeeded in obtaining the freedom of your wife, but I cannot obtain it for your children. The unhappy father swore that nobody should take his children from him. He concealed them in the woods for some days, but they were discovered and taken. The father was put in jail, and the two oldest boys sold to Georgia. One little girl, too, to be of service to her master, was left with the wretched mother. The other three were carried to their master's plantation. The eldest soon became a mother, and when the slaveholder's wife looked at the babe, she wept bitterly. She knew that her own husband had violated the purity she had so carefully inculcated. She had a second child by her master, and then he sold her and his offspring to his brother. She bore two children to the brother and was sold again. The next sister went crazy. The life she was compelled
to lead drove her mad. I would 10,000 times rather that my children should be the half-starved paupers of Ireland than to be the most pampered among the slaves of America. I would rather drudge out my life on a cotton plantation
the voice
until the grave
of
opened to give me
Gloria
rest
J. Brown Marshall, along with voices from the
mistress.
Some members the of the community, also other producers, Barika Tahir Edwards, Malika Lee Whitney, all a part of the serialized reading of incidents in the life of a slave girl. We're going to wrap it up now. Our newscast is coming up next over WBAI. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next week at 11 o'clock. 99.5 FM WBAI. We'll try to take more of your phone calls. You folks, we'll try to get to you a little earlier in the program.
Well practiced in means to evade it. What he could not find opportunity to say in words, he manifested in signs. He invented more than were ever thought of in a deaf and dumb asylum. I let them.
From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin, and here are some headlines. The U.S. reported more than 215,000 new cases yesterday and over 2,500 new deaths from COVID-19. COVID-19 fatalities have soared to more than 2,200 a day on average, matching the peak reached last April, and cases per day are over 200,000 on average for the first time on record. The crisis is all but certain to get worse because of the fallout from Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. FDA scientists released their first scientific evaluation of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine yesterday and confirmed it offers strong protection. The analysis comes ahead of a meeting tomorrow where the agency's independent advisors will decide whether to grant emergency authorization. Federal officials have said they expect the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine to be authorized within days of the meeting and that the first vaccinations may take place within the week. However, current vaccine supplies in the U.S. will be limited for quite some time. For many Americans, the best hope of getting a shot by spring or early summer may rest on vaccines that have yet been proven to work, such as the doses being developed by Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca. To be clear, those doses must meet the same standards met by Pfizer and Moderna vaccines before being authorized for public use. Britain's National Health Service is warning today that people with a history of significant allergic reaction to a vaccine, medicine, or food should not be given the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine. The warning came after two healthcare workers who got the vaccine yesterday experienced adverse reactions. Both patients are recovering as UK regulators investigate. The FDA documents released yesterday showed that side effects were experienced by just over 0.5% of people who received the Pfizer vaccine candidate in a clinical trial. And as wealthy nations are securing their supplies of COVID-19 vaccines, international organizations are warning that poorer countries will be left out. The People's Vaccine Alliance, a coalition of health and humanitarian organizations, said today that the world's richest nations have hoarded the coronavirus vaccine, warning that unless the pharmaceutical industry and governments take action, only 10% of people living in nearly 70 poor nations will be vaccinated by the end of 2021. The People's Vaccine Alliance is calling on all pharmaceutical corporations working on COVID-19 vaccines to openly share their technology and intellectual property through the World Health Organization's COVID-19 Technology Access Pool so that billions more doses can be manufactured and safe and effective vaccines can be available to all who need them. President-elect Biden on Tuesday laid out a 3-point plan to begin defeating the coronavirus pandemic during his first 100 days in office, saying he will sign an executive order the day he's sworn in to require Americans to wear masks on buses and trains crossing state lines, as well as in federal buildings. Biden also pledged to distribute at least 100 million vaccines during that time. Another goal of the plan is to enable the majority of schools to reopen. He called on Congress to devote the funding needed to make it safe for students and teachers to return to classrooms. The Trump White House offered congressional Democrats a stimulus proposal yesterday as CARES Act funding is set to expire this month. The proposal from Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin meets the Democrats' demand for state and